Hi, Chris Bentley here. Thanks for downloading this episode of Here and Now Anytime. We have some great stories in the works, deep dives on the arts, the environment, childcare, and much more. To get those, plus the top news of the day, make sure you subscribe or follow us in the app of your choice. Just search for Here and Now Anytime. And if you're already subscribed, I'd love it if you told a friend about us. And thanks. Now here's the show.
As much as we know about the Tuskegee Airmen and the Buffalo Soldiers, I really want to see the Montfort Point Marines get that same level as part of American history.
Remembering some overlooked trailblazers on Memorial Day. It's Monday, May 29th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today's Memorial Day. And in a few minutes, we're going to hear from one of the first black men to serve in the Marines. He's now 95 years old, and part of an effort to spread the word about black Marines who came up through Camp Montfort Point. And because it's also the unofficial start of summer, movie critic John Horn steps in for a preview of what Hollywood's cooking up over the next few months and how the writer's strike is starting to affect the film industry. But first, what's in that deal on the debt ceiling President Biden struck over the weekend with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy? Republicans wanted to force the country to default on its debt unless Democrats agreed to cut spending on social programs. And it worked, sort of. There are some cuts in exchange for raising the borrowing limit through next year, but nothing like Republicans had been calling for. Jeff Stein's been following the back and forth for The Washington Post, and earlier today he told Robin Young Republicans did get a few of the things they were demanding.
I would say there are maybe three really big Republican wins here. Domestic spending will be frozen for next year. That's, you know, not a huge Republican win, but it's better than the pace of the increase that we would have seen otherwise. The other two big wins I'll mention quickly for the Republicans is that they are clawing back about a quarter of the expansion of the IRS that the Biden administration approved last year. And then they also won significant new work requirements, particularly for the food stamps program that they have sought. Republicans say some of these aid programs discourage Americans from working. Democrats strongly disagree with that. But as a part of this deal, they enhanced some work requirements on food stamps.
Okay, go back to the IRS. This was, I think, something like $80 billion that was pledged to the IRS. It was meant to track down largely wealthy tax evaders, you know, bring more revenue into the government. Now, yes, some of that has been clawed back, but it's going to be redirected?
That's correct. And it's a little bit of the legislative mechanics and accounting gimmicks they sort of needed here to get to a deal. But about a week ago, we were at, and I was reporting what seemed like an insolvable impasse, which was that Republicans were demanding really steep cuts to domestic programs as their price for raising the debt limit. And I and others were looking at that and saying, how are they going to get a deal? And the compromise was to basically freeze the domestic programs and in exchange claw back $20 billion of the $80 billion you mentioned for the IRS. At the outset of negotiations, the Biden administration had seemed to indicate that that proposal was completely off the table. But as negotiations got closer and it looked like they were going to really decimate programs like Head Start and rental assistance for poor people, the White House sort of seemed to realize or recognize that paring back some of the IRS expansion was a less steep price to pay than they would have had to pay if they had to decimate these domestic programs.
Okay. And talk about the work requirements for federal food stamps, for instance.
Yeah. So the key change here is that they changed the work requirement expectation on food stamps from 50 to 54. So that means that if you were previously, let's say, 52, you were not required to demonstrate that you would work 20 hours a week to qualify for food stamps. Now, because the threshold is moving from 50 to 54, let's say you're 52, you do have to do that. The Biden administration will say and has said that they've won concessions that go in the other way, where work requirements have been loosened for veterans and the homeless. The administration is saying sort of that maybe that will counterbalance the effect of tightening the work requirements for that older age group.
What else can President Biden say he won in this negotiation?
Really, the key thing that the president won is the ability for him not to have to deal with the debt ceiling until after the 2024 election. And also, to be frank, he minimized the amount of cuts to government spending that Republicans had been pushing in a way that I think the White House can credibly claim that if they had, as you mentioned at the very beginning of the show, just had a normal negotiation over the budget rather than the debt ceiling, just the you know, what the government spends every year, instead of this negotiation wrapped up in this calamitous bomb threat of the debt ceiling, that he could have had to agree to this anyway. So he kind of saves face here and avoids the worst dramatic cuts. And he also just clears the deck of this issue, this sort of massive headache that they've been dealing with until after the next election. Yeah. Given everything we're hearing, they're likely to vote this through Wednesday or Thursday, which means we should be able to move on by then.
Jeff, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Robin also got the view from the Biden administration, courtesy of National Economic Council Deputy Director Bharat Ramamurthy. And she started by asking him, did the president give too much away?
No, I don't believe so. I think the president accomplished two very important things with this agreement. Number one, took the possibility of a first-ever default on our debt off the table. A default would have meant an almost certain recession. Number two, recall that Republicans were pushing for devastating cuts to all sorts of programs that middle-class, lower-income families rely upon. And the president drew a line against that. In essence, what we have here is a deal that locks in the same level of funding for those domestic programs that we had in the previous year, which in and of itself was an enormous increase compared to a couple of years before. Overall, not everybody got everything that they wanted, but it's a fair compromise, and most importantly, it preserves the economic progress that we've made in the first 2 years of this administration.
Well, you're right. Many Republicans are very unhappy. They wanted to get rid of a lot of the clean energy incentives that the president has been pushing. They wanted to get rid of his plan to forgive $400 billion in student loans. None of that is in there. Republican Chip Roy tweeted out that the deal is a turd sandwich. Forgive us if you have kids in the car. You know, have to hear that phrase all day. But again, as you know, on the Democratic side, Connecticut Rep. Jim Himes told Fox News he was leaning towards a no vote. The deal would add these new work requirements to food stamps. Now, it does exclude veterans and people experiencing homelessness from that work requirement. But here's Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington, calling the changes really unfortunate. She was on CNN's State of the Union yesterday.
Very bad policy, does not save money, and by the way, does not work. We've seen reams of data that show that when you put these work requirements in, they're really just administrative red tape that prevent the people who need help from getting help.
And we spoke with a researcher who said the same thing. Explain exactly what the administration agreed to on food stamps.
Yeah, so look, the Republicans were pushing for new work requirements for older workers who get food stamps, the SNAP program. The president was very clear that he was not going to do anything that would have the effect of taking away food from children. So any older Americans who happen to have dependents are not covered by these new work requirements. But there was another very important thing that the president fought for. He fought to make sure that the homeless and veterans are excluded from some of the restrictions in the SNAP program. So that means, depending on the exact numbers, I think you could actually see overall a net increase in the number of people who are able to get access to this important food support over the long term. Another important thing is that these requirements are both phased in over time and then phase out in 2030. So it's a relatively short period of time for these new requirements to be in place.
And by the way, when you say older workers, I believe the age was 54.
That's right. The current work requirements were in place for workers up to the age of 50. Republicans wanted to push that up to 54, but the homeless and veterans of any age are actually subject to lower requirements now. There are certain time limits on how long you can receive SNAP benefits. Those are eliminated for those two categories for workers of any age.
Would you agree with those who are pushing for Democrats to vote for the bill that a big win for President Biden was being able to keep this debt limit raise for 2 years instead of the one that many Republicans wanted, because it takes it past the next election?
I think less important that it's past the next election and more that we avoid this cloud of uncertainty hanging over the economy for the next 2 years. What this deal avoids is some of the more severe changes that the Republicans were pushing for. They wanted to impose work requirements on Medicaid recipients. The president drew a line in the sand and rejected that. And as I noted, some of the other major priorities that the president secured in his first 2 years in office, all of those clean energy tax credits, for example, those are protected as well. So this is a compromise where nobody's going to be 100% happy with it. But at the end of the day, the core progress that we've made over the last 2 years are preserved. And that's why the president encourages both the House and the Senate to pass it very quickly.
National Economic Council Deputy Director Bharat Ramamurthy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Deepa Fernandez speaks with a decorated veteran who started his career in the Marines not long after that branch of the military became the last one to integrate. Now, he's part of a team trying to tell the story of America's first Black Marines. That's after the break.
To a little known part of American history, the exclusion of African Americans from the United States Marine Corps. It was only in 1942 that Black Americans were first allowed to enlist in the Marines, making it the last branch of the armed forces to integrate. But the mere fact of entry into the Marines did not mean equality had been achieved. Far from it. The first Black men to enlist were sent to their own segregated training camp, Montford Point. What those first Black Marines experienced is not well known. Many left the service and didn't talk of the experience to their family. Now there's a movement to honour the first Black Marines, and the task at hand is to find those who still might be with us. Many have passed on. First Sergeant William Jack McDowell, Marine Corps retired, was in that first group of African Americans to integrate the Marines. He served for 26 years, fought in three different wars, and has been awarded three Purple Heart Medals and a Congressional Gold Medal. First Sergeant Jack McDowell joins me now. Welcome, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
We're also joined by Sonia Smith Kang, the granddaughter of a Montford Point Marine. And his name was Corporal Arnold Anthony Smith. Sonia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to start with you, First Sergeant McDowell. I'd love you to tell me about the experience of being one of the first African Americans to enlist in the Marines.
Well, as a point of clarification, I wasn't one of the first, but I came along in 1945 after several thousand had already gone through Montford Point. And I joined when I was 17 and a half out of high school, came out of New York, and I wasn't used to a lot of racial problems in New York. And even at Montford Point Camp, which was 99% African American, there weren't any major problems with respect to race. We did run into racial segregation problems outside the base, and that was quite a bit of a shock to me, although I had heard about such things before.
What kind of problems did you run into?
The usual problems associated with segregation in the South during that era, primarily separate everything, separate restrooms, separate waiting rooms at transportation facilities. You just didn't socialize with people that were white.
And how did that feel at the time where here you are getting trained to go away and serve your country, only to step out of that environment and straight back into a segregated America?
Coming out of New York, I thought it was rather silly, a waste of time and talent. We were in a world war at the time, and I just felt that it was very strange that at least people in uniform trying to serve the country as they can were being discriminated against because of the color of their skin. Didn't make any sense to me.
So why did you want to be a Marine?
My brother actually went in a year before me and came home and told me all kinds of stories. And being a silly kid, I thought, that's for me. And I decided to follow in his footsteps.
Mm. You ended up serving in three wars. You lost a leg. I imagine you saw things most of us never, ever will. Yet when you came home, I imagine you endured racism and racist systems. How did you deal with that after putting your life on the line to fight for freedom, you know, for all Americans?
Well, you can imagine thousands and thousands of Marines and Army and Air sailors were engaged in an effort, a huge effort throughout the Pacific Ocean area. And we went into Japan on occupation duty and also northern China. And by the time I was 18 and a half, been halfway around the world back in North Carolina, in a nutshell, going through that and being in segregated units back in the States, and then when the Korean War broke out, that was the first time that I had served with white troops after having been in the Marine Corps for 5 years. Mm. Didn't go well initially, but it worked out. In January of 51, I was wounded for the first time and sent back to the States for medical reasons. And following that, the Marine Corps started becoming racially integrated. And I have to say that over the years, it took a while for people to get used to an integrated Marine Corps. For the rest of my time in the Marine Corps, another 20 years, it went rather well. There were incidents from time to time, as you can imagine, but overall, I think the Marine Corps has done a pretty good job of integrating.
You've seen some progress in your years.
We didn't have any black officers at the time from 42 to 49, but now we have black generals in the Marine Corps.
Yeah. That's some progress. I want to bring yes. Sonia Smith-Kang in. Sonia, your grandfather, like First Sergeant McDowell, was a Montford Point Marine. Yet your own father didn't know about that service until he found your grandfather's Marine's uniform hidden in the attic. I wonder why your grandfather, Corporal Arnold Anthony Smith, didn't talk about his Marine service.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, you know, my grandfather was a very prideful man and he saw a lot. You know, he was there on the first day of fighting in Okinawa. He didn't talk about it to his children. And my father found, you know, some artifacts of his and really, you know, started to wonder and explore that part of his father's life.
And your own father followed in his father's footsteps, joining the army. There are many who believe that African Americans have not been accorded the freedom and the equality at home that they fought for overseas. How do you and maybe your father reconcile this?
Yeah, at the time, my grandfather and the other Montford Point Marines, you know, they were trailblazers. And, you know, as much as we know about the Tuskegee Airmen and the Buffalo Soldiers, I really want to see the Montford Point Marines get that same level as part of American history. And to come from, you know, to fighting during a war when at home they're also fighting racism during Jim Crow South. And I think it took a very special person to fight, you know, against foreign as well as, you know, for a country that didn't see them as human at times. So I think that's the challenge.
And you're now helping to find other Montford Point Marines or their families to help them get the Congressional Gold Medal, which is recognition of what they did all those years ago. Tell me about what going through this experience for your own family has meant to you.
It was absolutely the best thing I've ever done because I met amazing folks along with the First Sergeant. And my family was lucky enough to get ours in November of last year. And I want other families to experience that same moment as we did.
So why is it so hard to find these Montford Point Marines?
Once I do these conversations, and I'm sure First Sergeant can also chime in, you know, I think something happened to the records. Is that correct? Wasn't there a fire or something that happened?
Yeah, it was some records repository for the original Montford Point Marines and others was stored, caught on fire back in the 40s or 50s, and a lot of the records were destroyed. So it was a bit of a challenge for the Department of Defense to recover what they could.
Right.
And so you figure this, there were 20,000 roughly that went through. We've awarded somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3,000 replica medals. That leaves about 17,000. Families. The last recruit that went through Montford Point was in 1949. That would make him around 92 now. There aren't a lot left. we're all gone. We're all in our 90s. And, you know, the average age for Black Americans in this country that pass away is 77. So there aren't a lot left to tell the story.
First Sergeant McDowell, you've seen so much in your lifetime. You're 95, and the Marines now have, as we were just talking about, Black men in the highest ranks. Does this tell you that your initial sacrifices have come good, or do you feel like there's maybe still more work to do?
Of course, there's always a lot more work to be done, but I think the Marine Corps is doing a wonderful job today in training young fellows and ladies to become Marines around and to provide them with an opportunity to get the kind of training that's in today's world, I think, very important.
Well, we thank you for your service, First Sergeant William Jack McDowell, Marine Corps retired, and we thank you for joining us here on Here and Now.
Thank you, Deepa.
And Sonia Smith-Kang, granddaughter of a Montford Point Marine, thank you to you as well.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
Coming up next, movie theaters are still fighting for eyeballs with the streaming services, and they're still cranking out summer blockbusters from some familiar franchises. After the break, Deepak gets a preview of some of the biggest movies slated for release this summer. That is coming up right after the break.
Memorial Day traditionally marks the beginning of the summer movie season. Disney's new live-action version of the classic The Little Mermaid opened this past weekend.
I want to be where the people are. I want to see them dancing, walking around on those, what do you call them? Oh, feet.
But if family films aren't your speed, you could also check out the latest Fast and Furious film, Fast X, or Fast 10, which has the usual car chases and mayhem.
Get out of there, it's gonna blow!
Boom! Still to come, The Flash, the latest Mission Impossible film, and what Harrison Ford says is his last Indiana Jones movie. So is it business as usual at the box office? Let's ask John Horn, arts and entertainment reporter for NPR's LAist, 89.3 in Los Angeles. John, hi, welcome back.
Happy to be with you. I have to say, hearing that Little Mermaid clip reminds me of an amazing video that you can find on YouTube of Howard Ashman, the lyricist, working with Jodie Benson, who recorded the song in the animated version. Howard Ashman unfortunately died soon after that. But the way that he worked with Jodie Benson and that song, it's such a beautiful song. Check it out.
I will.
The song still works. Fast and Furious, I don't know if it still works, but anyway, that's for others to judge.
What are your thoughts about the upcoming movie season, John?
Well, I think it's going to be a lot of familiar titles. I'm going to tell you about some of the coming films and some that have just come out. You tell me when you've spotted a trend. Guardians of the Galaxy 3, Little Mermaid, Fast X, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, Transformers, Rise of the Beasts, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1. There's a Part 2 of that, Haunted Mansion. Yeah, a lot of sequels, spinoffs, remakes, knockoffs, whatever you want to call them.
Pick out for us from that, what should we prioritize in seeing?
I love the Mission Impossible movies, so I would definitely put that down. I think the first Spider-Man animated film was also great. You know, Transformers has its audience. I'm not among them. But I think in terms of movies that are going to deliver, Mission Impossible, that franchise has done incredibly well. The others, I'm going to have to wait to see. But there are some also really interesting movies coming out. Chris Nolan's movie about Oppenheimer comes out on July 21st. There's a comedy called Theater Camp that I've seen that comes out July 14th. Pixar has an original movie called Elemental. It's about characters who are fire. trying to live in an environment where there's also water. So there are some really interesting movies that are definitely not sequels, reboots, franchises, spin-offs, whatever you want to call them, that look to me very interesting. Those are the films I'm looking forward to.
Yeah. So, John, let's talk about another non-sequel film that opens this month. It's called Asteroid City, and it's a new film by acclaimed director Wes Anderson. It's got a star-studded cast, including Tom Hanks, Bill Murray, Tilda Swinton. Scarlett Johansson appears as a famous actress. Let's listen to a little bit of a scene.
You took a picture of me.
Uh-huh.
Why?
I'm a photographer.
You didn't ask permission.
I never ask permission.
Why not?
Because I work in trenches, battlefields, and combat zones.
Really?
John, tell us more about the film.
I love that. That's Scarlett Johansson talking with Jason Schwartzman. I mean, this is one of those things. If you like Wes Anderson, you will like this movie. If you don't like Wes Anderson, you will really not like this movie. It is Wes Anderson on steroids. It is about a junior stargazer convention that is disrupted by a UFO. But the question is it a UFO or is it a play about a stargazer convention where a UFO appears? It's got all of the Wes Anderson touches. You heard how the actors speak. The shots are all framed in a very distinct Wes Anderson way. I think it's a really interesting film. I won't say it's up there with, you know, some of his best, but it's also very unlike everything else we talked about.
Sounds fascinating. And kind of very different from the one that I saw a trailer to just this past weekend for the new Barbie movie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Ken.
Gotta say, John, I was kind of like, huh?
Do not knock Barbie. A couple weeks ago, I was at the annual convention of movie theater owners in Las Vegas. It's called CinemaCon. And the filmmaker behind Barbie, Greta Gerwig, came out and showed some footage. I think Greta Gerwig is a fantastic filmmaker. This is a super stylized look at Barbie. I think it's challenging the stereotypes that surround the doll, the toy. I'm not sure what we call Barbie. Margot Robbie plays the title character. It looks amazing in terms of its production design. And at this theater owners convention, they showed a good long clip and it looked really good. And then I talked to theater owners who were there. Almost to a person, the movie they were most excited about showing was Barbie. So
really,
we'll see.
Wow.
I thought it looked great, but I'm a big fan of Greta Gerwig. She's made some amazing films. She made Little Women not that long ago. So fingers crossed, I think it's going to be great.
I would give it a chance because of Greta Gerwig, but I will say I was a bit confounded by the trailer. And you're mentioning, you know, talking to these movie buffs who run theaters. Do they feel like we're now back from the pandemic, John? Because there are so many movies coming out for this summer. Feels like we're back.
Sort of. I mean, we're back to something resembling what movie going was pre-pandemic, but I don't think we're ever going to get back to pre-pandemic levels. So right now, the year-to-date box office is $3.1 billion in terms of tickets sold. You go back to 2019, the first full year before the pandemic, ticket sales at this same point were $4.1 billion. 2018, $4.6 billion. So they're running $1 billion behind 2019. Mm. That's, you know, 25%. And the more telling statistic, I think, is that 10 years ago, the average moviegoer in North America saw 4 movies a year. That number now is 2. And a lot of that you can attribute to streaming during the pandemic, but the numbers were declining even before 2020. The other thing that I think is worth noting is that there are so many ways in which we can consume content now in terms of streaming, on demand, pay cable, you name it. The movie theater model has not changed in a century. If you want to go see a film, you have a choice of maybe 8 movies at a local multiplex. You have to go there at a certain time. You have to sit through, you know, maybe 20, 30 minutes of trailers and commercials. It has not changed. Yes, there are new seats. You can have, you know, nice snacks and drinks. You can recline. But again, the model has been the same for a century. And I think streaming has proved that that model it always was a little outdated. I think it just proved how outdated it really was. So yes, movie theaters are back to a sustainable business, but I don't think they're ever going to get back to pre-pandemic levels.
And John, while we have you, we want to ask about the Writers Guild of America strike, which has already affected many television shows. Is the impact starting to be felt in film production as well? And could that impact next year's summer film season?
It could. I mean, some movies that are in production, they are shocking, remaking Blade. They have stopped production on that film. It probably wasn't going to come out for another year and a half. But according to the Guild, you cannot do any rewriting on any movie in production now. So if you have a scene that doesn't work, you can't write it. Maybe a director can try his, her, or their hand on tinkering with it, but it is not going to be possible to fix scripts. Movies that are about to go into production are being held. Now, there's enough movies that have been wrapped and are editing or in post-production now to last through the end of the year and probably into about the beginning of next year. But independent film that has a quicker turnaround, those movies might be affected. And it really depends. I don't see any immediate end to the strike. The parties aren't even talking right now. So if it goes on, and some people in town are now saying it could last through at least the end of July, it is going to have an impact on the summer movie season.
John Horn, entertainment reporter for NPR's LAist 89.3 in Los Angeles. He also hosts Retake, LAist Studios podcast. John, thank you as always.
Deepa, my pleasure. Great to talk.
Thankfully, there's still some non-blockbuster fare getting made. The last two movies I saw in theaters were Bo is Afraid and Blackberry. If they're still playing around you, you should definitely go check them out. They're both fantastic. Also, if you missed our conversation last week with the writer and director of You Hurt My Feelings, the new film starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, you can find that in the Here and Now Anytime feed from Wednesday, May 24th, or at our website, hereandnow.org. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan, Sam Rafelson, Ashley Locke, and Emiko Tamagawa. And as you probably know, Ashley Locke hosted our podcast last week while I was out, so thanks, Ashley, for that. Today's editors were Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard. Technical direction from Patrick O'Connor and Max Liebman. Max also wrote our theme music, along with me and Mike Moschetto. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening on this long holiday weekend. We'll be back tomorrow.